time has come for me to speak out about the charges made and to provide a perspective on the issue for the American people.
I believe it can be said without dispute that 1974 was the most consequential of all the 1970s for the United States. As the year opened, the question before the country was whether Richard Nixon would remain president.
It is my constitutional responsibility to defend the integrity of this great office against false charges.
Hearings in the Senate the previous year had established that the Nixon White House was populated by a combination of thugs and crackpots, all in the service of preserving Nixon's presidency and doing in his perceived enemies. The very paranoid Nixon fatally confused opponents with enemies who were out to get him, and so the thing to do was to get them first. He was an odd figure to be such a successful politician. He didn't particularly like people and was awkward around them. As 1974 began, Nixon was already in trouble over the raid on the Democratic National Committee's headquarters in the Watergate building complex in June 1972, the year of his reelection campaign. The group was mainly Cuban, still bitter over John F. Kennedy's failed attack on Fidel Castro's Cuba, and it was led by former CIA and FBI rogues. Their ostensible job was to find out who had carried out various leaks, and thus they referred to as the plumbers. But their real role was to get the goods, as Nixon would say, on his enemies. He had a re-election coming up in 1972, and he and his aides were determined to see to it that the Democrats nominated the weakest possible opponent. The White House goons were to undermine anyone who might be strong. So, in the end, the Democrats nominated a very liberal anti-war candidate, and Nixon won overwhelmingly. Egged on by his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, Nixon was also obsessed with getting the goods on Daniel Ellsberg, a former Pentagon defense analyst who had leaked to the press sensitive documents called the Pentagon Papers. What the world didn't know was that the plumbers had already raided the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist in California. It was because of this earlier raid, also botched, that Nixon and his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman, decided after the burglars were caught at the Watergate that the work of the plumbers had to be covered up, and so their silence had to be bought. But in court, one of the burglars squealed that they'd been pressured to be silent. Even Nixon, a lawyer, understood that the raid on a private citizen's doctor's office was a serious violation of the Fourth Amendment to our Constitution's right to be free of intrusion, based on English common law principle that a man's home is his castle. Also drawn from the old country was the principle set by America's founders that so as not to be ruled by a king, which after all they were rebelling against, the American president must be held accountable between elections. Thus, they wrote into our Constitution that a president could be impeached by the House of Representatives for, quote, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And should a majority of the House vote to impeach or indict a president, he would then be tried in the Senate, where a two-thirds vote was needed to convict or remove that president from office. This had never happened. Only one president, Andrew Johnson, Abraham Lincoln's highly controversial vice president, who succeeded him upon Lincoln's assassination, had been impeached in 1868 on largely political grounds, and his conviction fell just one vote short in the Senate. This left the Congress in Nixon's time without any precedent. The idea that Nixon might be faced with impeachment took hold after a Saturday night in late October 1973, when in an effort to get rid of the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, who was trying to obtain the secret tapes of Nixon's Oval Office conversations, the president in effect fired two successive attorneys general until he found a Justice Department official willing to fire the prosecutor. It was a very scary night. The president seemed out of control. It soon fell to the House Judiciary Committee to invent the process of impeachment. The vexing question for the committee members was, what constitutes an impeachable offense? They had little to go by. Chairman Peter Rodino and his top advisors understood that the country would never settle for a partisan impeachment and that such an act would fail in the Senate. They had to win the votes of conservative Southern Democrats and moderate Republicans, both of which groups barely exist in America today. In order to try to attract such members, the more radical leftward members of the committee had to be sidelined, and they were. Nixon and his aides and allies, of course, opposed the work of the House Judiciary Committee, but they didn't fight it anywhere to the degree that President Trump and his allies have tried to undermine his investigators. Like now, they tried to play on people's impatience, saying such things as, 1 year of Watergate is enough. It need be understood that this was a scary period. We knew that people in the White House would take extra legal steps to achieve their ends. We joked with dark humor about whether we were being wiretapped. It became a matter of honor to be on Nixon's enemies list. The House Judiciary Committee members who handled the Nixon case were aware that they were making history and setting important precedents. When I spoke with them, they described to me their agonizing over their decisions. Would they actually take a step toward removing a president from office? They met in small clumps. The Republicans resisted pressure brought on by the Nixon White House and its allies. The committee members wrestled with the question of the extent to which it had to be proven that the president had been directly involved in the actions under scrutiny, or whether a pattern of misbehavior was damning enough to warrant impeachment. The majority Democrats proceeded with an attitude of mourning sorrow. However they felt, they dared not appear to enjoy what they were doing. One Republican said to me that there was a great difference between wishing Nixon were gone, which many of them did, and actually voting to remove him. Finally, on a Saturday afternoon in late July, the committee took the first vote on impeaching Richard Nixon on Article 1 for his and his aides' participation in the cover-up of the Watergate break-in. In the end, the vote was 27 to 11 in favor of impeaching the President of the United States. The three Southern Democrats and six Republicans supported the first article of impeachment of a president in over a century, and the first non-political one. An historic precedent had been set. Most of the members cast their votes very quietly. Some stared at the ceiling. A couple of them had tears in their eyes. I sensed a widespread feeling not of triumph, but of sadness and exhaustion. There was also a sense of foreboding about unimaginable next steps. What was the strange, cornered man in the White House going to do? The second article of impeachment was more interesting and may have set the most important precedent for history. First, it proposed to impeach the president for failing to live up to the oath of office's requirement that he, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. This article also charged the president with abuses of power by trying to use federal agencies to pursue his enemies through wiretaps, tax audits, and the like. And most important, it held the president accountable for a pattern of actions of his aides. In other words, no more winking and nodding on the part of a president without having responsibility for what his aides understood that he wanted them to do. Article 2 also held the president accountable for jeopardizing individuals' rights by setting up the plumber's unit, and this included the raid on Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, an action that received little attention and hasn't since, but it may have been more significant than the Watergate break-in. This article was adopted more easily. The dam had been broken, as was the third one, calling for the impeachment of Nixon for failure to respond to subpoenas for evidence. By this time, there was no question that the House would adopt the committee-approved articles of impeachment, and it was slowly dawning that the Senate would probably convict Nixon and remove him from office. This would leave Nixon not only disgraced, but without his pension or other staff support, usually granted an ex-president. While the Senate trial was being arranged, the Nixon White House, which had so astonished us so often, did so again. In late July, the Supreme Court had ruled unanimously that some subpoenaed tapes had to be turned over to the federal courts. On August 5th, Nixon suddenly announced that three more tapes had been discovered, and that their transcripts, which the White House was about to release, quote, may further damage my case. He had that right. One excerpt caught Nixon instructing an aide to arrange that the CIA tell the FBI to stay the hell out of this. Here was clear-cut obstruction. Republicans who had been defending Nixon felt used and were enraged. While a lot of people still say that the damning tape determined Nixon's demise, it really changed nothing but the timing. It sped up the ending. Nixon had already been weighing whether to resign rather than go through the disgrace of being removed from office by the Congress and also losing out on the benefits he coveted. He needed a staff to write his memoir and to earn some money and to try to establish his reputation, which, astonishingly, he later did. But Nixon was the first president of the United States to be forced from office. For what it's worth, there's never been any evidence that the pardoning of Nixon by his vice president and successor, Gerald Ford, had been prearranged. I thought then, and I still do, that Ford did the right thing. The country would have been distracted for at least another year while Nixon was tried in the courts. Being forced from the presidency was plenty of punishment. It was tense to the end. The Secretary of Defense gave orders to his military commanders that they were to obey no orders from the White House that didn't go through him. While Nixon was still mulling whether or not to resign, on August 7th, he was visited in the White House by three Republican leaders of the House and the Senate. Reluctant to advise him to resign, they told him that his support in the Senate had collapsed. That evening, he told his family at dinner that he had decided to resign. And so, on television the night of August 8th, President Nixon made his last address to the nation from the Oval Office. He said what he had said he would never do, that because he lacked sufficient political support in the Congress, he would resign. He used to insist that the United States didn't have a parliamentary system. Now he announced that his resignation would be effective at noon the next day. In saying goodbye to his staff in the East Room the following day, also televised, in a strange rambling speech, Nixon spoke once more of his mother. She was a saint. And now he was Theodore Roosevelt, with whom he identified himself as, quote, the man in the arena. And then Nixon showed more self-knowledge than we had ever seen before. Revealingly, he advised his staff,
always give your best, never get discouraged, never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you. But those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
Moments later, Nixon and his wife boarded an olive-colored Marine helicopter to take him to Andrews Air Force Base and a presidential-sized plane to return them to California. As he paused in the doorway, he turned to face the crowd. He shot out his arms with his hands forming his iconic Vs. At noon that day, he was no longer president. The ending seems inevitable in retrospect, but it didn't feel inevitable at the time. Our democracy was preserved, but going through it felt like a closer call than historians may think.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn?